You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Angus Soderberg.
And I'm Claire Doyle.
And today's episode is part of The Arc, a special series that explores connections between climate change impacts, our climate responses, and justice. In this episode, Claire and I speak with Dr. Renata Giannini, who's a fellow here at the Wilson Center.
Dr. Giannini's research focuses on the intersection of gender, conflict, environment, and climate change. She was a program manager and senior researcher at the Igarapé Institute for 11 years, where she coordinated a project on the challenges faced by women environmental defenders in the Amazon. Now at the Wilson Center, she's building on that work to draw out the role of women environmental defenders in mitigating climate change. In this conversation, Dr. Giannini shares stories and solutions from her work with women environmental defenders in the Amazon and looks ahead at COP30 in Brazil. Renata, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really thrilled to have you on this podcast.
It's my pleasure.
So you have conducted extensive work on protecting women defenders of the Amazon. You've researched gender, climate, security, promoting democracy, and you've supported civic engagement in Latin America. Can you tell us what inspired you to get involved in this cause and then how that grew into your current research and work?
Oh, of course. And thanks for this question. Sometimes people don't really talk how we got here, and I really like to talk about it. But I think most of all, as most things, it was completely by chance. It started out completely by chance, at least for the gender equality part, working with gender. But of course, because I've been working mostly within think tanks in the ideas business, it's also a matter of the context. So about 15 years ago, right after I finished my master's program, I used to work on civil-military relations. And because of that, I was taken to a project that was examining women in the military in peace operations, and I was in Haiti. And while I was doing the field work, some military women from one particular battalion, among the peacekeepers, they came to me and asked for help because they were being violated, assaulted by their counterparts every day. And I don't know why I was so surprised with that. I was completely taken aback because I was there researching those people and looking into how they were interacting with the civilian population, protecting. And then all of a sudden I saw that violence was happening. And that really was what triggered. Afterwards, like I did my PhD focusing on gender issues. And when I went back to Brazil and I went to work in a think tank, I started to see inequality and gender inequality specifically as a cause for almost all the complex challenges that we see nowadays. And so one thing led to another. So throughout the years, I've been doing that, gender mainstreaming in different topics, in different themes, in different projects. And in 2019, when former President Bolsonaro started his term in Brazil, I was really taken aback once again, because in Brazil, we had a military dictatorship in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And it felt quite personal to me. My father was very much persecuted at the time. And a lot of people have lost family members. And what we saw, it was that being critics to the government was being treated as an enemy of the state. And what I liked the most to do, which was doing research and informing public policies, was not able to do that anymore. And most importantly, because channels of participation, civic engagement was completely being curbed. So I started to really deal with that and monitor what was happening. And of course, in that context, we realized that one of the most attacked areas was the environment. And so deforestation was on the rise, burnings, And so, then I wanted to know what's happening with the women, what's going on. If the Amazon is burning, what's the impact on women? So that's more or less how I get here.
So through the Wilson Center, you've been working on a project titled The Guardians of the Amazon, Women Defenders' Role in Mitigating Climate Change. Could you give us a brief description of kind of what you're exploring there with that project and what you're learning? And if there's like a particular story that stands out from your research?
Yes. So when I started looking into the impact that, you know, basically historically, the relationship between the Brazilian state in the Amazon region has been exploitation, extractivism, and it has not been a very good story to be told. And so when I started looking into the impact that an authoritarian government was doing to the Amazon, I realized that there were two main things going on. First, the levels of violence against women in the region is twice the national average in Brazil. Why is that? What is it about this particular region that leads to so this increased violence against women? And the second thing is that we all saw how people were being persecuted. And there was a very, as the deforestation was on the rise, so were assassinations against environmental defenders. But when you look into the data, women are not that many. It doesn't mean that they're not suffering violence though. I think it's as much as we see like homicide rates in the country, 91% of the homicides in Brazil are against men. That does not mean that women are not being assaulted, that they're not suffering. And so I coordinated a survey to try to understand what were the risks and vulnerabilities that women defenders were suffering for taking a stand, for being a protagonist in the fight against deforestation and other environmental crimes in the Amazon. And so once I finished that, and that's what I'm doing here at the Wilson Center, I wanted to look at the other side of the coin. So I'm looking here at the vulnerabilities. I was looking at how they were disproportionately affected. But what are they proposing? What are they doing now? How are they actually taking a stand, contributing to climate change mitigation? So right now, what I'm doing is that I have a list of all the water and land conflicts that are currently taking place in the Amazon. And I'm looking to the ones that have a very strong woman as a leader. And I'm looking, what is it that she's defending? How she's defending, and what's the impact of that to climate change mitigation. So for instance, there's a story that I like very much, which is the Guajajara women warrior. So in the Amazon, there are several parts of the Amazon that are protected because they are indigenous territories. And it's very common within these territories that a group of indigenous patrol the area because the state is not really able to do that. And there was a group of women that took over that role and started patrolling their territory. And in the end, what the main results that they had was the following. In 2016, if I'm not mistaken, deforestation in that particular territory had been of 2,000 hectares. A few years later on, when they started patrolling, the deforestation yearly in that particular area was of 96 hectares. So it decreased 20 times. And of course, that has a huge impact considering that Amazon is a large carbon sink and, you know, all the other benefits that the forest itself offers. And a second story that I'm digging into is of Alessandra Munduruku. She's very well known. She has gotten a few prizes. Now, she lives in a different territory. It's indigenous as well, but that one has not been formally recognized. And she has been doing something that many of the defenders with whom I work with are doing. They're taking law classes. And they say, it's because I need to speak your language. And so in this process, she learned that there were 23 applications of a mining company to explore her territory, which is not formally recognized as an indigenous territory. And so she you know, outreach to media, to other indigenous populations, to other partners. They wrote an open letter. There was a huge outcry. And because of reputation, this particular mining company, after some time, dropped the applications to explore that particular area. And after that one, another two also dropped. So she managed to protect the territory. So of course, that has also a huge impact. You know, when there's mining exploitation in the Amazon, there's, you know, contamination of the river, of the fish, and of course, forest clearing. So basically what I'm doing is like mapping these stories and trying to really concretely put in terms what were their contributions to climate change mitigation. So I told you two stories. I'm collecting several. I hope to contribute somehow with that.
That's really interesting. Yeah, thank you for sharing those stories. And I appreciated how you described this journey of first focusing on the challenges that women are facing and then wanting to move towards, well, what are these women proposing? How are they taking a stand? I think, and we're actually going to get back to this later, but I think often women are seen as victims in these contexts. And so it's wonderful to see this kind of narrative shift in collecting all these stories about what they're doing to positively contribute despite the challenges they face. That said, I do actually want to take a moment to talk about some of these challenges that you worked on maybe earlier before this transition to collecting stories, since we know that women are often disproportionately impacted. And you spoke about, you know, these women peacekeepers who are facing violence, which is really sobering. And we know that, you know, many environmental defenders face persecution around the world. I think in 2022, something like 177 environmental defenders were murdered. And of course, many more faced violence and other kinds of threats. Do you think gender roles play into the kind of threats that women defenders in particular face? And could you kind of outline how that might be the case? And what are some of the other challenges maybe that women protectors face?
No, of course. So I coordinated a survey, which was very enlightening, because a lot of the violence dynamics that women defenders confront are very much aligned to violence, trends on violence against women in general. That is, historically, there are specific roles that it's expected that women will perform. And these women defenders, they are not only opposing these big projects, these, you know, illegal economies and so on. And from that alone, they receive a lot of setbacks, but they are also confronting gender norms. They are not staying at home. They are not staying quiet. They are taking a stand. They are being politically active. And that's not expected for women. When you look into the data, you have throughout the years, at least since Global Witness started to collect this data, you have, I don't remember, it's a huge number, like three, I think it's 378, but it's huge. How many of these are women? 33. It's a lot less. Does that mean that they're not being assaulted, violated? No. It means that the trend of violence against women defenders is very different from that of men. And we cannot not take into consideration other identity markers, being peasants, being indigenous, being Black, being like from the riverine communities, rubber tappers, and so on. So these are not the big activist environment women that make it to the global stand. These are rural women. And so what the survey showed us is the following. Yes, they're being murdered. Yes, they're being physically and sexually assaulted. They're being threatened, but they are also being defamed, silenced. Their leadership is made invisible by other male counterparts. When you look into the perpetrators, the majority, like over a bit over 30%, is not acquainted. So it's people that they don't know. They were hired to do something to them. But the second is acquaintances. It's their community, their family, their neighbors, their partner. And it's most of the times it's domestic violence because they are not quiet, because they are taking a stand. So they suffer a lot of stigmatism in their own communities, and sometimes they are abandoned. And so many of the women whom I spoke to, there was a huge effect in terms of mental health, of being displaced, either because they were threatened that they have to leave their territory and they're not able to go back. And those women, not only the women, but I don't know how you say in English, like we say the literal translation is the forest people, because it's not only indigenous populations, the forest people. The relationship that they have with the territory is existential. An attack to the territory is an attack to them. And having to leave that is like leaving a piece of you behind. And so these are some of the violences that we've collected throughout the years. And one last point that I wanted to make on this is that one question that we had was, are you financially compensated for the work that you do protecting the Amazon beyond? 51% does not receive anything. So these are mothers who probably, you know, they have to take care of their children. They also have to take care of the environment or to protect, because that's very much related with their existence. And they also have to work or to do something to be able to provide for their families. And so it's there are multiplying effects, and we needed to take a better look at it. And actually, it was not the last point. The other thing, the last thing now on this point that I wanted to say is, but the good thing is that there are sometimes what I've noticed that they use these social roles that they have to perform as a strategy as well in the narrative. So they put themselves as the mother of a murdered child, as the wife as of a murdered activist, or as the responsible, like the food of their children is contaminated. And they use that narrative to sort of gather attention and try to do something about it. And these are the good feminists, right? Because they are still in their care role, but they're taking a stand as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about how they're using their gender roles as a way to garner more attention and support for the causes that they're promoting.
Yeah, and it's really also important to hear about how the different identities of these defenders are influencing their experience. So thank you for sharing that. But I'm curious if there are any mechanisms in place to protect them. You've written about the Escazú Agreement, which includes the right to justice when protecting a healthy environment. And since that's been implemented, I'm wondering how successful that legislation has been in protecting environmental defenders. Are you seeing any impact on the ground for these women?
Okay, so there are two things important to highlight, is that most of the countries, they do have a protection mechanism for defenders, but they usually, they don't take an intersectionality approach, which means that the way that they try to offer protection for indigenous populations, for women, is most of the times inadequate. And it's not enough. It's a lot of people being murdered in the Amazon countries as a whole, not only in Brazil. The second thing about Escazú specifically, Escazú was adopted in 2018 and it ain't coming into force in 2021. It's open for the 33 states in the Latin America and the Caribbean, but 24 signed and only 14 ratified, which means it's still early to say if it's being successfully implemented or not. However, it's remarkable in many ways. And the very fact that it's adopted in the region where you have the highest numbers of assassinations against defenders in the world is something that it should already be considered as a success. And so the first thing that I would like to highlight about Escazú is that it connects human rights with environmental rights. And that's quite unique. And it does so by recognizing the role that these defenders have protecting the environment and requesting members, parties to the agreement to really adopt protection strategies for the defenders to make them to have judicial support for free. And so that's quite remarkable. And the second thing is the fact that it considers the best way to protect the environment by promoting participation. So the active participation of people informing public policies about the environment as the main way to protect the environment. And I think that's fantastic. It's not only participation, but also transparency so that people have information and are able to take their stand, pressure their governments, monitor. And that's a democratic principle. So in the end, I think ESCASU manages to reinforce democracy and reinforce the ties between human rights, environmental rights in quite a unique way. So even though it's still young, I'm very hopeful that it will definitely make a difference in terms of protecting the environment and those that are risking their lives protecting the environment.
I think that point about public participation as the main way to protect the environment through the ESCASU agreement is actually a really good way to tie back to the earlier part of our conversation about the solutions that the women in your research are pushing forward and what vision they see for a world that protects the environment and human rights more robustly. So I want to go back to that. And you recently wrote a report with the Garape Institute called Challenges and Recommendations for the Amazon Through the Voices of Women Defenders of Human Rights and the Environment. And in that, you highlight a few key solutions that women defenders are proposing. I think you're pulling from a specific group of women that you worked with there, but these solutions can be applied more broadly. So can you walk us through some of these ideas and solutions that are being put forward?
Yes, of course. That publication is the result of a few participatory rural appraisals that I coordinated in the Brazilian, the Colombian, the Peruvian Amazon. I published only the Brazilian one, but to be honest, the results across the three countries are not that different. And the underlying point, there are three underlying points. And I think the first one is the relationship between the state and the Amazon region. It needs to be thought of differently. Historically, as I've mentioned before, it has been a very exploratory relationship. And so what it means is that the services that are provided by the state there, they are either lacking or they don't have an intersectional approach, a much needed intersectional approach to a region where you have a huge diversity in terms of ethnicity and race. And so not everybody has the access to public services in the Amazon. And so the state, the face of the state for this population is sometimes the state's completely absent. And the second thing is, of course, it's very hard to protect a very dense forest, which means that historically it has also been prey to many illegal armed groups that terrorize the populations. And of course, they explore the resources in a way that is really damaging not only the environment, but also bringing immense risks for the local population. So finding a way to be present, the state to be present, not only by providing adequate services, but also patrolling, protecting the area is fundamental. And the third thing that I would say is related to these women-led initiatives. We've talked about how women have developed throughout history, like social roles, what they are expected. But because of that, the way that they see sustainable development is different. And it's related to the roles they carry out, either because they are responsible for care, but because they are responsible for care, they are often also responsible for food production and for agriculture. So the amount of projects related to agroforest, for instance, that are very sustainable, that, you know, are able to produce enough food for many of the populations living there, but do not receive any sort of resource or support, is really huge. some women that I've spoken to, they're doing artisanal mining. It's still mining, of course. It's not in an industrial scale, but it's a way of taking advantage of these resources without damaging the environment. And so they're of course, they have many specific prescription of about how we should tackle the challenges, the development challenges in the Amazon. But I think these three general points is important. Just rethink the relationship between the state and the region. And it's not only the Brazilian state, the other states as well. Being able to better protect that area from illegal economies, armed groups that are there. And of course, support women-led initiatives.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I also want to dwell on something before we move on here about the link between the work and the solutions that these women are proposing as environmental defenders and climate mitigation. So again, kind of going back to earlier in our conversation, you spoke about how protecting the environment, specifically the Amazon, which is a big carbon sink, relates to climate mitigation, of course. Can you actually draw out that link more for us? I think sometimes the work environmental defenders is seen as separately or talked about as separately from climate and climate mitigation. And I'm curious to hear too, if there's a strategy there in framing this as climate work, because now we're seeing a lot more kind of support and mobilization around climate and climate action.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question, because it ties to something else that I've noticed. When I first started working with the defenders, the first thing that I noticed was sometimes they don't recognize themselves as defenders. Like, they're like, oh, defender? I mean, what is that? And when you ask them, what do you do? What they describe, they are defending the land. They are sometimes advocating for solutions that are environmentally friendly. So it's interesting that most of the times, however, they do not recognize themselves as defenders unless they were in touch with what I'm calling here the global stage. Like, they somehow managed to leave the region and be in contact with international organizations. They were exposed somewhere. So most of the times, they don't really realize the role they perform. But that's increasingly changing. To carry out that specific survey, I hired the defenders. So I provided them with research training and financial resources, because of course they were working. And so it was amazing experience to be closer to them and see how that is evolving. And I'm still talking to many of them. And so I think there are two things. There is a role when you talk about women in protecting the environment. Most of the times we associate with adaptation, not necessarily mitigation. But when they stop, like the example I gave on Alessandra, mining exploitation, for instance, are they really just doing adaptation or are they really mitigating? The thing is that it's very hard to measure the effect that was not caused because they managed to halt a process. Now, others are dealing with trying to stop forest clearing, for example, for pastures or for the agribusiness. And I think that's even clearer because most of the times forest clearing is done also through fires. And so what's that impact in the environment? And instead of having the big proportions of the forest cleared for pasture and for cattle and for soy plantation and other things, they are proposing agroforest, small agriculture. And so what I'm trying to do is to really uncover these more subsistence forms of development that really take a stand more in harmony with the forest and with the biome. So I expect that I will be able to support enhancing and putting a light into this connection more clear. Because I don't think it's just a matter of calling it climate action. I think it is climate action. And the fact that it's not recognized as climate action is actually problematic.
Right. And I think that's really important. It's important to recognize that the act of preserving the Amazon or defending, you know, its natural resources is in a way, you know, mitigation work. So thank you for sharing that. We want to end by looking ahead to 2025, when Brazil, where your research is focused, will host COP30. It'll mean that there's a sharpened focus on the region. And so therefore, also an opportunity to elevate women defenders in the Amazon as climate actors. So I'm wondering, how can we leverage the conference to bring more attention to these links and to support these women's important role in mitigation work?
Okay. Well, the first thing I want to say about that is, when I started working with the defenders, of course, the very first one I contacted is a very well-known one. So she has been to COP and so on. And she was very critical of it because, I mean, she doesn't speak English. She was taken there because there always is another organization that would be able to fund. And she was there and she spoke and she participated. But what's the impact, really? I think it's very important in these conferences. It's not only the states being convening and deciding and agreeing on several issues. It's the fact that civil society is there, and it's speaking, and it's really is trying to influence, as it should, and they should be heard. But they don't think they are actually heard in these places. At first, because it's very hard to get to these places. Secondly, because they don't speak the language. Now, having a COP in the Amazon, because it will be in the Amazon, I think will be really important. I've seen these women go all the way to Brasilia to protest, to try to convince the governments. And I expect that not only women defenders, but you know, the forest people will heavily be there. And I think that's an amazing opportunity to really give voice to those who live there and open the space for an active participation. And so I think this is the most important issue. Of course, if you go by plane, you see that sea of green of forest, but you also see a lot of smoke. And you'll see a lot of clearings. And that's, I mean, it's very impactful. It's very sad when you see it.
Well, thank you, Renata. These are really important insights into the work of women environmental defenders, and some sobering stories, but important to hear. And we're looking forward to following your work at the Wilson Center and beyond. And hopefully we can see some of these voices being elevated at COP30. Thank you.
No, thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about my research, and most importantly, to bring at least through my voice, a little bit of their voice.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at New Security Beat, and visit newsecuritybeat.org.